Welcome to The Daily Friend Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to The Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by two very exciting guests. Back on the podcast again, we have IRR CEO France Cronier. France, how are you today?
I'm very well, Nick, and it's great to be back so soon again.
Yes, very good to have you. And we are joined by Daily Friend contributor and writer extraordinaire, Ivo Vector. Ivo, how are you?
No, good afternoon. Very well, and yourself?
Very good. Right, let's get stuck into it. And I think, you know, we talked a little bit around this yesterday, but we didn't address it very strongly. And that is the one of the most important pieces of legislation to come out of government in recent years. And this is, of course, the revised land expropriation bill, which seeks to amend the way that the allow for the expropriation of property without compensation. So it has several important clauses, but the most important of which is that it gives a list under which relevant circumstances the land can be expropriated, but it includes the phrase including but not limited to, but we'll get into that in a second. So, of course, people have been expecting this for a while, and I think a lot of people who care about property rights are concerned. France, are they right to be concerned? There has been some media reporting that suggests otherwise.
Deeply so, Nick, and your intro was great because it shows the extent to which a fraud of sorts is being perpetrated against the people of the country. I mean, you're in our world, but you're so barraged, if that's a term, with the idea that this is a land reform measure, a land reform bill, that you almost introduce it as a land reform measure, a land reform bill, and then quite correctly corrected yourself. But it was, you couldn't have a better example for me of what has gone wrong and why I say a fraud is being perpetrated in the media against the people of the country. This expropriation bill is back. Sunday there was a media briefing. The government will proceed with it in all haste. It's terribly important. I mean, the irony of that announcement days before the government's recovery strategy is due to be announced, notwithstanding. A great concern has developed within the IRR over the last 48 hours at the media response to that announcement. And I will set out for you briefly what that concern is. Firstly, a lot of the media announcement has written, there have even been headlines, even in the business press, to talk about the land expropriation bill or South Africa's new land policy and land legislation. The expropriation bill is nothing of the sort and does not deserve that label. It is not limited to the expropriation of land. Its scope is sufficient to expropriate any fixed or movable asset in the country, all the way to intellectual property rights, shareholdings in companies, savings of households, what have you. It is that broad. It is intentionally being cast by politicians as the land reform bill in order to ease its passage through the sea of public opinion, in the hope that only when it's too late will the great majority of South Africans who are not commercial farmers realize that this bill has as deep implications for them as it has for any commercial farmer. It is not just about land. It is the entire property rights framework that is under threat. A second point that's been made in media reporting is that the bill has introduced new certainty. One of the business publications went as far as to suggest that it's even good for property owners, the bill, because it now makes it clear and certain what property might be expropriated and when and how that might happen. This is not true of the bill. The bill does contain a list of examples of where expropriation without compensation might occur. For example, if you buy a property as an investment and hope that its value will increase, the state could take that from you without compensation. That's one. There are five or six examples, depending on how you define them, of such categories. But the bill is explicit that that where expropriation without compensation will apply is not limited to those examples. So the list is meaningless. And for the media to report that this list, to suggest that it's almost a complete list, that nothing that a person who owns an asset who falls outside the scope of the list might be expropriated is deeply irresponsible. For example, Nick, you could have a new conditions added to that list. You could go as far as new policy that might say the state should nationalize all land in society. That would be perfectly acceptable. You could demand, for example, an indigenization policy, such as in Zimbabwe, that 51% of shareholdings in companies should be ceded to the state. So, if one, it's not about land. Two, it's far from certain about who's going to be expropriated and under what circumstances. If you concede those two points, you might find some solace in the fact that, well, the courts, you've been told in the media, are going to decide on when an expropriation might occur and on the compensation. And our courts, you might think, are still quite good. So, you know, even if you cede points one and two to us, the courts will save you. You are wrong. The courts will decide on expropriations. That is correct. But consider the procedures ahead of that point being reached. An agency of the government, of one deputized to do so, if you own an asset, remember it could be any asset, can approach you and say they intend to expropriate your asset. They can enter into negotiations with you about how to do that. If they don't like where those negotiations are going, they can simply tell you that they intend to expropriate it and ask you to make a submission. You can then make a submission to the government, which the government might consider, but does not have to consider and does not have to respond to, at which point the state can issue a notice of expropriation, including the date at which this expropriation will occur. Only once that has happened, a fait accompli, will you contest this in the courts. So take the example of an investor that loses a productive asset. It's only after losing the asset and the source of income that person can consider whether they wish to, with what resources and money they might still have, to engage in long-term litigation against the litigation war chest of the government. It's completely misleading to suggest that the courts are going to be a sufficient backstop here. The fourth point that's made in media reporting over and over in the last 48 hours is that, well, you know, that this might be quite extreme legislation, but it probably won't be used extensively. Last night in an interview on a radio station, an attorney, I think for Werksmans, so I'm very confident, involved in the expropriation legislation, advisor to government, suggested that this legislation would not be used widely at all. I have no idea why an attorney working for a private firm has such deep insight into how government in years and decades ahead might use a piece of legislation that affords them this degree of power, particularly when you consider the nature of that government, the present accusations of corruption against it and many of its senior leaders, and its rapacious appetite for resources given the country's diminishing tax base. So for any expert to suggest this will have most limited use is quite naive, particularly when you consider that even in the hands of Mr. Ramaphosa, I'd have serious concerns about this legislation, allowing it to be driven. But if he is no longer in charge, the lineup, the hierarchy in Luthuli House is Ace Magashula and David Mabuza, who will inherit the responsibility and the power to use this legislation. And lastly, once you've said that, the counter that you confront is that, well, you know, this is all very serious and it probably is going to do some harm to investment, but South Africa has no choice. And it has no choice because expropriation has become a political necessity. There is such a mass yearning amongst people to go and farm on little plots of state land that if the government does not capitulate and essentially nationalize commercial farms and give them to the poor peasantry, South Africa will survive, will endure a violent revolution. And that will be much worse than any consequence of the depleted or depressed investment that might flow from this. It is a nonsense, a myth being perpetrated by the media and politicians on the country. We've done proper deep dive polling over years. And it stands out time and time again that land reform is not seen as a policy priority by South Africa's people in the sense of those people demanding the opportunity to go and carve out little plots of pumpkins and small little herds of animals in order to improve their living standards. Where there is a demand for land reform, it's a quite a reasonable expectation that people who lost a property as a result of racist past policies in this country will be sufficiently compensated, which a proper restitution process, well-financed and paid for by society, the societal good, taxpayers, not individual property owners, could quite easily address. And I can tell you further, and I dare them to challenge me on this, that internal polling done by the ANC found, when it asked its own members, what do you want? That's a very good question. It's a bit more complicated than that, but that land reform came 13th on the list. And if you think of 13 things you want the ANC to do for you, you'll struggle to get to 4 or 5. The fact that land reform is so far down the list shows that it is not the great policy priority. Demands for it are not the great priority. And the government knows this. I assure you it knows this. I know this. And in that case, if there's not such public demand for mass expropriations, then it would suggest very strongly that what lies beneath this move towards the expropriation bill now is something that should have every South African very deeply concerned. And Nick, over to you.
Very chilling stuff. And of course, the reason that I made that error of referring to it as the land expropriation bill was because in my notes here, I actually took headlines from the media, and one of them described it as government introduces revised land expropriation bill. So I think you're completely correct in how this is being framed in the media is a bit misleading. Ivo, you are a warrior in the battle of ideas. That's what you trade in. And I just want to get your impression of the bill, and then secondly, your thoughts on maybe how we can push back against it in the marketplace of ideas.
Well, you know, in the first place, Franz, I agree entirely with everything that you've said. This bill does not specify under which circumstances land might be, or any property for that matter, might be expropriated. And that really is what an expropriation bill should be doing, assuming that expropriation is legitimate in the first place. But, you know, phrases like including but not limited to the following cases, well, that means that they can do it in absolutely any case whatsoever. I've got some issues with some of the examples that they cite. You know, one of them is where an organ of state holds land that is not using it for its core functions and is not reasonably likely to require the land for its future activities in that regard, and the organ of state acquired the land for no consideration. You know, and I'm thinking, well, I don't care what the organ of state acquired the land for in the first place. If it is not using it, then the organ of state has no business owning that land. So that land should be redistributed, and there is a lot of state land that should be available for redistribution on those terms. And then, of course, there's the main one, where it says the land is not being used and the owner's main purpose is not to develop the land or use it to generate income, but to benefit from appreciation of its market value. That goes to a very common misconception about economics, and that is the notion that speculators are actually damaging to the economy, that they harm the economy in some way, that you know, that ordinary people who buy and sell things for a purpose are harmed by speculators who merely buy and sell things for profit. Well, in the first place, all people who buy and sell anything are inherently speculators. If you buy and sell shoes, you hope to buy low and sell high. You may not always succeed, and in that case, you'll make a loss and you'll eventually go out of business. But you're basically speculating that you can sell shoes at a later date for a higher price than you bought them. So the notion of speculation is quite vague. But what speculators do is that they sort of even out price fluctuations. Right, so they will buy in times of plenty when there's a lot available, a lot of supply, and prices are low. They will buy something, and that could be a widget, that could be a plot of land, doesn't matter what it is. And then at some future time, when demand is high, supply is low, and prices rise, they make this land available. So in the first scenario, when they're buying, they actually put a floor on prices. So they actually save a lot of people from selling properties at lower prices than they might without the speculators. And then in the future, when the prices rise and the speculators sell to take their profit, if the speculators hadn't been there, the prices would have been even higher. You know, so they even out that curve, that those swings between low and high price periods. So speculators actually do the market a great deal of service. So the notion that, you know, just holding land for the purpose of profiting from appreciation, that this is somehow bad for the economy, absolutely wrong.
Yeah, and the precedent that they had set. Sorry, Nick, I just quickly want to come in behind Ireland. The precedent, if you expand, if you take land is just an asset as at some level, as anything is. The precedent that gets set becomes very dangerous. Are you holding any asset? And this is just one microcosm of the implications of this policy. Are you holding an asset or a business for speculative reasons? Is that does that become an intrinsically objectionable to South Africa's policymakers, expand the precedent down the line, and the implications just on that one point become quite ghastly.
Yeah, no, indeed. You know, I mean, you could take it to cars. I mean, a lot of people buy old classic cars, and they hope that those cars will appreciate in value. You know, well, fair enough. Your Ford Cortina in the 1980s might not have had a lot of value, but a Ford Cortina in pristine condition that you've had for 30 years or 40 years and done nothing with, might actually sell for a good price these days. That would then be illegal. You know, but it goes back to this shoe example. I mean, it would become illegal to buy shoes low and sell high and hold them just because you're trying to profit from the appreciation in price. You know, stocks and bonds, you know, exactly the same thing. Everyone speculates on stocks and bonds. Whether you call it investing or not, it doesn't matter.
The question I'd urge people to ask is what sits in the mind of a policymaker who can conceive of just this microcosm. Now, we've not dwelt on this one microcosm of this bill, but let's stick there. What sits in the mind, what ideological predisposition makes it possible to draft such an idea? And how does it pass through reams of policy advisors and lawmakers and politicians and cabinet ministers unchallenged to anyone with the least appreciation of the importance of markets and free enterprise? That wouldn't survive the early drafting. The fact that it gives you, if you reverse engineer the thinking in a sense, a clause like that gives you incredibly valuable insight into the ideological disposition of South Africa's government.
Nick? Quite correct. It shows that they do not accept the virtues of free markets, that they do not understand the virtues of free markets and are not prepared to legislate accordingly. You know, they believe, and it's like what happened in Venezuela. You know, when they started expropriating, they initially expropriated idle land and idle villas, right? So you know, what we would call holiday homes or something. That's what they started expropriating. Then they said, well, farms that aren't productive enough by some standard that the government bureaucrats came up with, you know, underproductive farms, they would be expropriated and taken over by the state or redistributed to people who, in their minds, might farm that property better. Then they started looking and they said, okay, but some farms are actually overproductive, which harms the environment. So therefore, those farms now also need to be expropriated and the state needs to take control. And this needs to be redistributed to all the people. You know, eventually you've got so few farmers left that the entire purpose of their expropriation program was food security, right? Was to improve food security and reduce Venezuela's reliance on food imports. By the time they were done, Venezuela was importing six times as much food as when they started. It is completely contrary to what the purpose of the whole program was.
Yeah, and you're quite right. Venezuela started.
I don't think it's the same way.
Venezuela started, and then I'll give it back to you, Nick. Sorry. Venezuela started with the unused land, and they were cheered by the gallery of commentators and activists who thought this would help to bring about a great social revolution. But policy creep, something I wish more people could understand the danger of, saw those initial erosions of property rights grow into a monstrous assault later on civil liberties and the rule of law, given that property rights underpin substantive human liberty in every free society. And if I've failed in any respect in my comments earlier, it's that I haven't gone far enough and perhaps have stressed too strongly the economic consequences. But property rights underpin substantive human liberty. And when you erode those property rights, let alone when that erosion is cheered by the media and civil society activists, you necessarily, and there are no exceptions, set into motion a chain of events that culminates in the erosion of civil liberties and the rule of law, and later the very oppression of the people that the government nominally but unconvincingly would maintain it sought to help in the first place. Nick, it is back to you now.
Indeed, it seems as though we are on the road to serfdom. My final question to you, France, is what can ordinary people do to fight back against this?
Well, you can fight it and you can win. And the approach is always the same. It's these are the battles the IRR has fought in this country for almost 100 years. The winner in any great ideological contestation is always the side that at the point of a great crisis has injected the greatest volume of compelling argument into the public domain. It's the battle of ideas to shape public opinion. Ultimately, public opinion will shape public policy, even in draconian societies, although there the pain and suffering is much deeper and it takes a lot longer and the cost to human liberty is much greater. What you need to do is to become informed. You need to share this information within your own circles of influence. You need to correct people who call this, I completely understand, given what they've read in the media, the Land Reform Bill, when there is no such piece of legislation. If this sort of thinking is parroted within your institution, business, or frame of reference, you need to take steps to point out its danger. And you need to support the institutions and individuals, small band that they are, in taking this fight into the public domain and alerting people to the dangers so that the tide of public opinion can put the brakes on policymakers. We fought this expropriation bill, Nick. It's not something that appeared on Sunday. We fought it and defeated past iterations of it for the better part of a decade. You can fight and you can win these things, but you need to get compelling arguments in front of vast numbers of people in order to influence balances of opinion and hence balances of political power and make the costs of proceeding too great for the government, because enough players in the society, from the rural poor all the way to large corporations, realize the immense cost that they will pay as a consequence of this, particularly if they are seen, as some South African corporates now are, as party or at least indulging of such a very dangerous piece of legislation.
Indeed, it is a bit of the fight of our lives. Anyway, let us move on very briefly to, in the last 5 minutes here or so, to just talk about something that Ivo's written recently. Ivo, please tell us about an article you wrote recently regarding the WHO and its stance on lockdowns.
Yeah, you know, the WHO has always been sort of, well, a bit equivocal about lockdowns, but it's implicitly endorsed national lockdowns throughout the whole COVID pandemic, which started in sort of February for most of the world. Now, a very senior official who is the special envoy on COVID-19 for the WHO and reports directly to the organization's director general, Professor David Nabarro. He appeared on an interview with Andrew Neil, one of my favorite interviewers, actually, for Britain's Spectator TV on the weekend. And he said, "We in the World Health Organization do not advocate lockdowns as a primary means of controlling this virus." I wish they would have told us this in February or March. You know, they were obviously still thinking about it. But his basic argument is that national lockdowns have done immense harm and, you know, have had very little benefit. He said the only time we believe a lockdown is justified is to buy you time to reorganize, regroup, rebalance your resources, etc. You know, so he might have agreed with our initial 3-week lockdown, but not with the extensions, and certainly not with the very extended lockdown levels that we see to this day. He called it a terrible, ghastly global catastrophe. And he said that, you know, we must remember that lockdowns just have one consequence, that you must never, ever belittle, and that is making poor people an awful lot poorer. Now, it struck me that, you know, I've been writing this right from the start. You know, when we first went into lockdown, I said, this is, we're marching into totalitarianism, and I genuinely fear for the poor, you know, and for unemployment numbers and so on. This is going to kill a lot more people than the virus ever will. Organizations like Panda came up, there's a group of actuaries, and they're sort of expanding internationally now. They made the same point. They said, look, a lot more people are going to die because of, you know, hunger and malnutrition and not getting medicine for HIV or TB or cancer, or, you know, not getting stroke treatment or heart disease treatment because of all these lockdowns. So the consequences are really going to be very, very negative. And it's interesting to see that the Spanda group, led by Nick Hudson, they have recently appointed a scientific advisory board, which has some global experts on epidemiology and the various fields that are relevant to this question. And they launched what they call the Great Barrington Declaration on the 4th of October 2020, right, which makes exactly the same points. So it seems that kind of all of us are in agreement now. You know, the international epidemiological experts, the WHO, me, Panda, we're all in agreement that lockdowns cause more harm than good, and we really should be fighting this virus in far more sensible ways. You know, I don't object to mask wearing or hand sanitizing and social distancing. That makes a lot of sense. But stop closing down entire economies or entire sectors of the economy, because that does a lot more harm than good.
Now, you exactly. Know, Nick,
sorry, France, go ahead.
When we criticized lockdowns, Nick, as the IRR, we faced some scathing criticism of racism, of not caring about the poor. I mean, mad stuff, considering that the motivation was to protect vulnerable people from the devastating economic consequences that have now been allowed to play out in the country. And the sentiment pro-lockdown was incredibly strong. 6 months later, that mood has changed. And it's changed in part, great part, because of the influence of Panda, who I'm proud to say we were very interested in from the beginning and gave airtime and space platforms where no one else would. And it's a nice way to end for me today, because it allows me to complete the answer to your question to me of earlier of, can we fight and win these battles? You can, absolutely, in exactly the way that pandas helped to fight the battle against these crazy lockdowns, by demonstrating to public opinion and placing pressure on policymakers to abandon fundamentally bad ideas. The same rule book applies to how we will beat the expropriation threat facing South Africa. That's it from me for this afternoon, Nick. Thank you very much. Thanks, Ivor. It's great to talk to both of you.
Indeed. And if you want to support us, you can go to irr.org.za, click the Join Us button, and sign up to become a friend of the Institute to support our battle against EWC. Anyway, thank you very much to both of you for coming on, and thanks to everyone for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow on The Daily Friend Show. Have a great night, everyone.